Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Homage to the Blessed One, the Worthy One, the Supremely Enlightened One. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
When we have the opportunity to listen to the teachings of the Buddha, it can be helpful to imagine that we're actually in front of the Buddha as he's saying these words, because we know that that there were real people alive in the time of the Buddha who listened to these discourses, who asked questions, who tried to put these teachings into practice. And one of the qualities of the Buddha's teaching is that it's something that we have to take into our own lives, right? It's not just a philosophy that we learn. It's actually something that we have to practice. So for some of us, it can be helpful as we're listening to the teachings, whether we're the one listening or whether we're the one reading, to imagine, right, that the Buddha lived in India. He stayed in very pleasant monastic parks, monasteries, and when people had the opportunity, they would go to him and listen to his teachings. If they had a question, they would ask. Otherwise, they would just wait for someone to ask a question or wait for the Buddha to share some teaching. So that's what happened in this discourse. Someone went to see the Buddha. So the Buddha was living in Savatthi, the northern city that he spent a lot of time. And instead of being in Anathapindika's monastery, as he often was, he was staying in the eastern monastery donated by the laywoman Vishakha. So he was in Vishakha's monastery, and a Brahmin came to visit him, named Gannaka Moggallana. Moggallana, the accountant. So some Brahmins did have professions. Some Brahmins were farmers. Some Brahmins, as we see here, were accountants. And some Brahmins took care of the religious duties. So this particular Brahmin was an accountant. And he goes to the Eastern Park and he finds the Buddha. He pays respect. He inquires about the Buddha's welfare. The Buddha inquires about his welfare. They have some polite conversation. This is a very normal thing. Even when people would go and see the Buddha, they would have a little bit of chit-chat, friendly chit-chat, just like we do here today. So after he had paid respects and had some polite conversation, this Brahmin, Gannaka Moggallana, asked the Buddha. He said, "Master Gautama, in this palace of Nigara's mother, there can be seen a gradual training, a gradual practice, and a gradual progress, that is, down to the last step of the staircase." So here, the language, when it translates into English, it doesn't make as much sense. But he says, we can see in this palace that was built. So not only did Vishakha donate the land for the monastery, but she built what can only be described as a palace. 500 rooms on the first floor, 500 rooms on the second floor. So 1,000 altogether, so 1,000 monks could stay in it. It's interesting to know that monks are allowed to stay in a palace, if you have an extra palace and you wanted to donate one. Monks are allowed to stay in a palace. It's just all the nice stuff that's inside the palace that has to get checked out. But the, you know, the walls and the ceilings, it just becomes a room. So when you're reading and you say, oh, the palace of Megara's mother, why are monks living in a palace? Well, it's an empty palace in the sense that it's big rooms, but or a big building, but none of the luxuries that really make a palace fun to live in. So this Brahmin says, we can see this gradual staircase that goes from very high up to very down to the bottom. He says, among the Brahmins as well, we can see this gradual progress, gradual training, gradual practice. That is, the training in scriptural studies. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the jobs of Brahmins was to study the scriptures and to memorize them. And that there was a gradual training that they underwent in order to be able to do that. He says, we can see the same thing with archers. People who are professional archers, they also have a gradual training, right? Maybe they they spend some time just learning how to hold the bow, and then they spend some time with a target that's quite close by, and then little by little, the target gets moved further and further back. So he says, with them as well, we can see a gradual training. And even among us, as accountants, when we get someone to train, there's a gradual process. First, we have to teach them how to count to 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And we keep training them more and more until they can even count to 100. That was, you had to be count to 100, I guess, back then to become an accountant. So he says there's this gradual training, a gradual process. He says to the Buddha, now, is it also possible, Master Gotama, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dhamma and discipline? So, in your teachings, can we find this same sort of idea, that there's a gradual training, a step-by-step process that people go through? So the Buddha replies, it's possible, Brahman, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dhamma and discipline. Just as, Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit, and afterwards trains him further. So, I don't know how many of you have trained horses before. I haven't, but I've read about it. So the first thing that you have to do is to have a way to control the horse. Right? Horses don't come with handles, very convenient. So they have to wear a harness, and they put this metal rod back in their mouth, right? So it goes all the way back behind their teeth. And it's a horribly unpleasant thing, right? It's not just because they're a horse, it's not a big deal. It's terrible to have something jammed into the back of your throat, but that's the best way to control a horse. When you have that harness on, when you have their head back, in that much control, then you can do what you need to do with the horse. So when someone's training a horse, they have to make the horse get used to these things. Right? If they decided, okay, I'm just going to put this bit in the mouth, put the harness on their head, put the saddle on, and just jump right on them and start riding them, it wouldn't work. Right? Because they've got this thing stuck in their mouth and it's horrible, and so how can you expect them to be calm and concentrated enough to ride it? So the Buddha says, just as Brahma, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, first he makes him get used to the bit and afterward trains him further. So when the Tathagata, the Buddha, obtains a person to be tamed, First, he disciplines him thus. Come, bhikkhu, come, monk, be virtuous, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, be perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. So, the Buddha says, it's true. For my disciples, there's also a gradual training. There's a step-by-step process. Now, it's true that when we read the scriptures, we can see that there are some people whose minds are already so pure, who already have such good, wholesome conditions, such previously done good actions, that they just hear a little bit of the Dhamma, a few words of wisdom from the Buddha, and right away they can understand it. Right away, they may even attain the first stage of enlightenment. But for most people, it only comes after quite some time. So the Buddha says, this is my gradual training. When I get someone, the first thing that I do is instruct them in ethical behavior. So for lay people, it's the five precepts that we talked about earlier today. For monks and nuns, it's a set of rules known as the Patimokkha. So, for lay people, every day you have five. Do you remember what they are? Abstaining from killing, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from sexual misconduct. Fourth one, from lying. Yeah, and the last one?
Intoxication.
Yeah, abstaining from intoxicating drinks and drugs. So for lay people, this is the foundation that if we expect to train the mind in very subtle states, if we expect to be able to concentrate the mind, if we expect to develop wisdom, if we expect to be committed to understanding the truth of the world, if in our bodily actions and our verbal actions, we're not also committed to the truth, we're not committed to honesty, it's very hard to develop these more subtle qualities. So, fortunately, the Buddha understood we have these different practices to do. And so, one of the foundational practices is training ourselves in good ethical behavior. So, for the monks, we have a basic set of 227 rules that we have to follow. So, for lay people, how many do you have? Five. Doesn't seem so bad now, does it? And as I said earlier, the rules for the monks and nuns kind of expand on these five precepts. So we have these same five precepts, but they get more and more refined. And we also have a process. Once we've broken one of the precepts, we need to go to another monk, or if we're a nun, go to another nun and confess what it is that we've done. So some of the precepts are what are known as deadly precepts, that if you break those, then you're no longer a monk or a nun. So if you engage in sexual intercourse, if you kill a human being, if you steal something of value, or if you make false claims about stages of enlightenment or meditation developments. So if you commit any of those instantly, you're no longer a monk. Doesn't matter if you're still wearing the robes, you're not considered a monk. And there's no repairing that. The Buddha says, just like if you have a rock and you break it in half, it's always going to be two pieces. Right? Even if you glue it back together, it's still split. Or if a leaf falls from a tree, it can never join the tree again. So in this present life, you would lose the chance to be a monk or a nun. Then there are other precepts that are very serious, but not deadly. So um, For example, if a monk engages in sexual contact that's not sexual intercourse, or if there's another one that doesn't get broken very often, but if a monk is asking for material to build a cabin for himself, a hut for himself, and he builds it too big, that's a very serious offense. And so for those offenses, you need to get together a group of monks and for 2 weeks, go through a process of confessing that offense and recommitting to keeping the training precepts. And then you need to have 20 monks get together to pass a resolution allowing you back into the Sangha. Even to become a monk, it only takes 5 monks. But to recover from one of these very serious offenses, it takes 20 monks. So in Canada, it can be very difficult. You might even have to go back to Sri Lanka or Thailand to get enough monks. But then most of the precepts can be overcome or can be cleared just by confessing. Or if the precept involved owning something that a monk shouldn't own, like money, for example, part of the process is getting rid of that object or forfeiting that object. And then you tell another monk, and then you're considered to be clear. It doesn't change the karma that we've committed, but it allows a monk to think, okay, I did this wrong thing, but now I've confessed it. This is what the Buddha said that we should do. Now I don't need to worry about the past. I just worry about the future. So the Buddha says, this is how he trains them. He says, come, bhikkhu, be virtuous, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, this set of rules. Be perfect in conduct and resort. So your actions should be good, the places that you live should be good. And seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. So this is a phrase that the Buddha uses from time to time, fear in the slightest faults. So this doesn't mean that we become neurotic or obsessive about things, but that we're really aware. So, for example, with lying, it's so easy to say things and afterwards think, well, that wasn't true. Did I know it wasn't true when I was saying it? Was it a lie? Right? A lot of times people come to the monks to ask about those sorts of things. And so what we need to do is to think, maybe I was lying. Like I didn't want to go to that game this afternoon. And maybe I didn't really have to do the thing that I said I have to do. Right? It can be messy. But what we want to get in the habit of is looking and seeing, maybe I wasn't totally honest that time. Next time, I'm just going to be more honest. I'm going to say something that's true, say something that is useful, but I'm going to be more careful. Right? So the Buddha said, we should be looking very carefully. We should take the precepts very seriously, thinking, am I really taking advantage of this opportunity? So for lay people, you only have 5 precepts. So you can work very hard to make sure that you keep those very carefully. Right? It's pretty doable. It's not always easy. Right? We may even find ourselves in a little bit of in a difficult position. Right? But at the end of the day, when we can look back and see, I tried as hard as I could to keep these precepts. I didn't hurt other people. I didn't hurt myself. And now I can go to bed very peacefully. I can meditate very peacefully. So this is a training both for lay people and monastics as well. So here the Buddha's really focusing in on the training for monastics. And as lay people, you can understand that these are beneficial to you in a couple of ways. So the first way is to always be listening for how you can take this teaching into your own life. Right? So, the Dhamma is true. The Buddha's teachings are true, whether you're a monk or a nun or a layman or a laywoman. Greed causes problems. Right? Hatred causes problems. Doesn't matter who you are. So, as a layperson trying to follow the Buddha's teachings, when you're listening to these scriptures, when you're reading them on your own, just because the Buddha seems to be talking to monks, or seems to be talking specifically about monks, we all need to look at these very seriously and think, okay, how does that apply to me? How can I also take this into my life? If it has to do with lifestyle, like not eating in the afternoon, right, then that's not something that lay people need to take up on a daily basis. But these other things, always be on the lookout for seeing, yeah, how can I also live by that? How can I also take advantage of this rare opportunity? So the other way, as lay disciples, as lay followers, people can take advantage of these teachings by remembering, the Buddha understood not just how to have happiness in this life, not just how to have a peaceful mind in this life, but he understood how to get to the root of the problem. And he understood that there was a way of life that makes it easier to get to the root of the problem. And that the Buddha had disciples that at the time that he was alive, and also disciples afterwards, who practiced these very same things. So when we're developing our faith in the Buddha's teachings, we also need to be developing faith in the Dhamma, the teachings themselves, and also the Sangha, those people who've practiced these teachings. Because if the Buddha just attained enlightenment on his own and didn't share his teachings, then we could still have a happy mind thinking about the Buddha, but we wouldn't get to benefit from those teachings. If the Buddha attained enlightenment and also shared the path, but no one else was able to follow that path, then again we'd come up short, thinking, well, it's great that the Buddha attained enlightenment, I really admire that, I really appreciate that. It's great that he figured out a way for himself, that's wonderful. I can rejoice in that. But if there weren't other people who also followed that path, then what chance would we have? Right? But there were many people, not just 10 or 12, but thousands and thousands of people in the time of the Buddha and since then, who've followed these teachings and gained a little bit of benefit, gained a lot of benefit, even gained the complete benefit of putting an end to the cycle of rebirth, putting an end to suffering completely. So, as we listen to these teachings, we want to keep both of those things in mind. How can I take these teachings into my own life? And also, how wonderful it is that the Buddha was able to teach these very deep things that people who are very committed can follow and take to the end goal. So, next, the Buddha says, when this bhikkhu is virtuous and seeing fear in the slightest fault, then the Tathagata disciplines him further. Come, monk, guard the door of your sense faculties. Do you know what the sense faculties are? It's a very fancy word. There's some technical words we have to learn. So the sense faculties in the Pali language, the eye, there are senses. So the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. So the mind is also considered a sense. And not just, maybe this is obvious, but it's not this part of the ear that's the sense base. It's the hearing ability. But we say ear just for short. So these are what are known as the six sense faculties. And each of the sense faculties has an external component. So for the eye, it's things that we see. For the nose, it's odors, smells. For the ear, it's sounds. For the tongue, it's tastes. For the body, it's things to touch. And for the mind, it's mental objects or memories or thoughts. So the Buddha says, he trains the monk this way, "Come, monk, guard the doors of your sense faculties. On seeing a form with the eye, do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you were to leave the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the eye faculty. Undertake the restraint of the eye faculty." So, the Buddha understood that we don't overcome our greed by covering up our eyes. If we could remove greed and hatred from our lives by covering up our eyes, plugging up our ears, sealing off our nose, right? Then we just do that, right? And we'd be happy. But it doesn't work that way. Because you seal all these things off completely, and what are you still left with? The mind, right? That we have to live with these senses, but we have to know how to use them. So the Buddha says we have to guard them, we have to protect them. That when we see things, so he goes sense by sense. He says when we see things, don't let greed overcome you. When you see the person next to you has the latest iPhone. Phones are easy to pick on because the world is working so hard to make us greedy for these phones, right? It's incredible. You know, they tease, they say, oh, you know, it's not even that they announce it, but like they tease it for a while, pictures get snuck out, right? People line up, right? Why? Because when we look at them, we get attached. We pay attention to the features. I mean, right there, like it's what happens, right? You look and say, oh, what are the new features of this new phone? Oh, it's waterproof, or it has so much whatever and stuff, right? Ah, you know, my phone, it doesn't have that. If only my phone had that, right, then I would be happy, right? There's a lot of people working very hard to make us think that way. It wasn't just in the time of the Buddha that people could see things and be greedy. Even now, right, we see these things. And if we're not careful, we look at things, we look at how beautiful they are, we look at how handy they'll be, and we think, ah, yes, I have to have that. And we sit down to meditate and we start to think about it. Maybe it's not a phone, maybe for you it's something else. But as long as we have that nature in the mind to be greedy, until we pull out that root of greediness from the mind, we still have that opportunity. We can hear beautiful things. We can maybe hear the voice of someone that we've fallen in love with, and we think, ah, how can I be close to that person? And I'll only be happy if I can get that person and hear their voice all the time. Right? We can listen to how sweet the voice is. We can learn to recognize it. Right? And if we allow our mind to get attached to that, then that's all we think about. We can see this in the world, right? Someone breaks up with a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and the other person who didn't choose to break up, right, there's this longing. Maybe they even, it's terrible, but it happens. Like they call them just to hear the person answer the phone, just so they can hear their voice. Or they listen to an old recorded message, right? It happens. This is how we get attached to things in the world. Right? We forget about the screaming that they also did. We think about the beautiful things. We want to hear the beautiful songs. So the Buddha says, we have to train ourselves that when we use the senses, not to get caught. When we get to eat delicious food, right? And especially as lay people, you know you're going to eat delicious food. You're going to have friends who invite you in and give you delicious things, right? Play beautiful music for you. So, as lay people, you may not be practicing this hard, but the solution is still there, available to you, because the suffering is still there, available to you. That if we get attached to the food, then we're going to suffer when we can't get that food. If we're attached to the sounds, if we're attached to the touch, and we don't get those things, then we have to suffer. One time the Buddha even compared these sense faculties to wounds. You know, like we might have a big cut on our leg. So if we had a big gash in our leg, what would we do? We would protect it. We would make sure that dirt and dust and bacteria didn't get into it. And we'd clean it. We'd take care of it. Right? Sometimes we might leave it open so it could air out. But we would protect it. The Buddha says in the same way, these sense faculties, we have to protect them. So especially when we start to notice suffering around the sense faculties, that's especially when we can see, yes, I'm not guarding my senses. I'm allowing my senses to reach out and to cling on to things. Right? So the Buddha says, next step, guard the senses. Next, the Buddha gets very specific about one of the senses. He says, when Brahman, the bhikkhu guards the doors of his sense faculties, then the Tathagata, the Buddha, disciplines him further. Come, bhikkhu, be moderate in eating, reflecting wisely. You should take food neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort, and for assisting the holy life, considering, thus shall I terminate old feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. So this is exactly what we recited before the meal today. It's very clear that food can be a problem, right? We have to eat. So you don't have to drink alcohol. No one has to drink alcohol. And of course, everybody hopefully is hearing now that all the studies that say, oh, you'll be healthier if you drink alcohol. Right? Now the whole wave of studies saying, no, actually any amount of alcohol is not good for you. It can lead to cancer. So alcohol, right, we can do without. Lying, we can do without. Stealing, we can do without. Sexual activity, we can actually do without. Food, we can't do without food. We have to eat. There's no way around that. Some religions say, no, you can commit the ultimate renunciation by giving up food and starving yourself to death. Right? Buddha didn't say that. The Buddha said, no, you need to eat. You have to keep the body healthy. Keep the mind healthy. But don't eat too much. Only eat for a reason. Only eat to nourish the body, to have calories so you can so you can stay alive, so you can stay healthy, right? Not to eat food in a way that we develop new feelings instead of getting rid of old feelings. So what's the old feeling? Hunger. We want to eat to get rid of the hunger. And we don't want to develop new feelings? Greed, right? So we want to end up even at the end of the meal. That we've taken care of the hunger, we've done what we have to do, and now we're going to live peacefully. So one of the advantages that the Buddha gave to his monk and nun disciples was, we just have to be happy with the food that people give us, right? If we start to fantasize about a certain kind of food, right, then clearly that's suffering for us, because we don't have money, we can't trade things to get what we want. Even if we start to sort of connive and hint and ask someone to give, right, then very quickly it's like, oh, that doesn't feel right. That's clearly not, you know, that's not why I became a monk. So for monks and nuns, we're very fortunate to have this practice where we just eat whatever people give us. As long as we know that we can digest it, unless we're sick, we can just eat whatever people give us. And so we cut out that whole seeking for food and things. But still, as lay people, right, we can practice with this thought. Right? Let me really think about food as a way just to keep my body healthy. If I want enjoyment, let me find something else to do to enjoy myself. Right? Let me disconnect those two things, enjoyment and food. Right? It doesn't mean that you don't make delicious food for your family or your friends. Right? When the volunteers try and make the food for the retreat, they're always trying to make delicious food. Right? Because that's on the side of the giver. On the side of the giver, you always want to make nice things. But on the side of the receiver, you want to be happy with whatever you get. So this is the next training. And you can see how little by little these things start to make the mind more calm, start to allow the mind to focus in on what's most important. Next, the Buddha says, I discipline that disciple further. Come, monk, be devoted to wakefulness. So in English, the word wakefulness, it just has a very simple meaning of not being asleep, right? Being awake. But in the Buddha's teachings, wakefulness has a very special component to it. And this is what it is. During the day, while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. In the first watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. So, wakefulness in the Buddha's teaching is not just staying awake, it's training the mind, purifying the mind of obstructive states. So, what are obstructive states? Hatred, anger, greed, delusion, right? Sleepiness, doubt. All these things are obstructions to the mind. That if the mind is overcome with hatred, overcome with jealousy, overcome with doubt, then we can't concentrate. We can't look wisely at the teachings that we're learning. So the Buddha says, you have to train yourself to be awake and to be looking at the mind, seeing what are the problems in my mind, how can I remove them. In the middle watch of the night, you should lie down on the right side in the lion's pose with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in your mind the time for rising. After rising in the third watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. So you can lie down and sleep in the middle of the night, but do it. So the Buddha recommends what's known as the lion's posture, lying on the side, lying on the right side with your legs crossed. But then when it's time to wake up and again, take up the practice of training the mind. That whenever we're, and we chanted this today when we recited the Karaniya Metta Sutta, whether standing, walking, sitting or lying down, whenever awake, purify the mind. Have these, if we're practicing loving kindness, try and have these thoughts of goodwill. Be on the lookout for the sense faculties, not to let them get attached to the external objects. Then the Buddha trains in what's known as mindfulness and full awareness, in Pali, sati sampajanya. The Buddha says, "Come, monk, be possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. Act in full awareness when going forward and returning. Act in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Act in full awareness when flexing and extending your limbs. Act in full awareness when wearing your robes and carrying your outer robe and bowl. Act in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting. Act in full awareness when defecating and urinating. Act in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, or keeping silent." So, the Buddha says, we should be paying attention to what it is that we're doing. We should be paying attention to where we put our body, how we move our body. Right? If someone hasn't trained in these other practices, if someone hasn't trained in the precepts, especially in the very refined way that monks and nuns have to in order to be aware of their surroundings all the time, if we haven't trained our mind to watch for our senses going out grasping onto things, if we haven't trained the mind not to get attached to food, right? If we haven't trained the mind to be alert all the time, then very hard to pay attention to how the body is acting. Very difficult to do this. It's a very complete awareness that the Buddha is asking us to have. Right? Even when we're defecating, even when we're using the toilet, the Buddha said, we should have this awareness. Right? This is what I'm doing now. Right, this is the nature of the body. Most people want to try and not think about that part of their life, but everybody does it. It happens. It's part of the whole package. It's part of why having a human body is a disadvantage in some ways. So then the Buddha says, next, when this bhikkhu possesses mindfulness and full awareness, then I discipline him further. Come, monk, go to a secluded resting place, a forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, so like a cemetery, a jungle thicket, an open space, or a heap of straw. So, it's interesting because a lot of people have this idea, oh, I want to become a monk and go live in the forest, right, far away from anybody. They walk in the door of the monastery and they say, okay, I want to be alone now. Right? But if we look at the Buddha's teaching, we see there's a lot of training that has to come before it's suitable for somebody to go off on their own like this. Right? Because if the mind isn't trained, it's like you're bringing your enemy with you when you go out to live alone. The Buddha says it's very hard to live secluded if the mind isn't trained. So after all these trainings, the Buddha says, okay, I tell this person, okay, you're ready to go live in a secluded place. Go there. And then when they've gone there, the Buddha says, on returning from his alms round, after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body upright, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness, So each of these are what's known as the five hindrances, the five basic problems that happen for someone when they try to meditate. So with this gradual training, with the right conditions, one is able to meditate in a way overcoming these difficulties. So when we're still training the mind, we have to be on the lookout for all of these things when we meditate. That greediness, desire, can start to overcome the mind when we meditate. So when we're meditating, we see these things happening, right away we want to think, okay, how can I not pay attention to this? How can I keep my mind focused? Do I need to reflect on the real nature of whatever it is that I'm greedy about? Right? If my mind gets stuck on the latest iPhone, right, I can think, you know, I felt this way about the last five iPhones, and they all break eventually, and I'm never happy with it by the time the next one comes out. Why don't I just give up this whole iPhone thing? Right? So that's just an example, pretty easy one to work with. That if we see that we're being greedy for something, we can actually work with that very specific thing on the spot, thinking, okay, I need to overcome that. Same way, the Buddha says, this person, abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassion for the welfare of all living beings. So this is the second hindrance, hatred and ill will. So in the same way, if simply not paying attention to the hatred that arises doesn't fix the problem, then we have to find an antidote. We have to intentionally think thoughts of goodwill and compassion, or shift the mind to another object that's stronger, that can keep our attention. Next, abandoning sloth and torpor, so sleepiness and laziness. He abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. So if we become sleepy, I've talked about this a lot today, if we become sleepy, on the spot, we have to fix that. Right? We have to do something to make the mind bright again. Because if we don't, we fall asleep. So when we read a passage like this, it can really warm our hearts because we think, ah, I'm not the first person to fall asleep during meditation. I'm not the only one that gets angry when I meditate, right? Because it can be kind of shocking. Like you sit down in a peaceful room, no one's attacking you, but yet we remember some wrong that was done to us. Maybe even as a child, right? Teacher, somebody got us in trouble with the teacher, and it starts to flame up in the mind. Right? But here we are sitting in a quiet, peaceful place with nice people around us, but yet we get angry. That's what happens with this mind when it's not trained. It's not something specific to us. One time I had someone come to me who was trying to learn meditation, and he said, you know, this terrible thing happens when I meditate. Oh, it's awful. I'm so embarrassed. I can't believe it. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I'm like, what's happening? He says, I fall asleep. I said, well, everybody falls asleep. Right? When the mind isn't trained, we fall asleep. We get angry. Right? We get greedy. We want things. This is what an untrained mind looks like. But the Buddha has this path. The Buddha has this process that we can use. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. So the mind can become agitated. We can start to feel guilty about things that we've done wrong in the past. We can start to have doubts about the Buddha and his enlightenment. We can have doubts about whether or not this meditation is even something that can be done. Right? All these problems can come up in the mind. So we have to train to overcome. So then the Buddha explains four very deep states of meditation. He says, when these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by sustained thought, applied thought, and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure, born of seclusion. So, when these five hindrances are gone from the mind temporarily, when we've overcome them through various means, then the mind can become very concentrated into these states known as jhanas. And we're a little short on time today, so I won't go into each one, but they're beautiful states of mind, peaceful states of mind that that little by little become more and more subtle, more and more refined. So at first, all these horrible things of hatred and greed and jealousy, when those are gone, then we have a kind of concentration that's filled with happiness, even a happiness felt in the body. And then as we get deeper and deeper in meditation, then even that excitement of the happiness starts to reduce. And we're left just with a peaceful feeling, with a completely concentrated mind. All of that is possible because of this gradual training. And many people, they're just interested in meditation. They say, oh, I just want to get these deep, blissful states of meditation. And they ignore this long process, right? These beautiful instructions that the Buddha gives us. So we're very fortunate that we get to learn about this gradual training. And the Buddha says, this is my instruction, Brahman, to those bhikkhus who are in the higher training, whose minds have not yet attained the goal, who abide aspiring to the supreme security from bondage. So he says, this is the training that I give my monks. When they haven't attained enlightenment yet, I tell them, this is what you need to follow. Then he says, but these trainings, these steps, they're also very happy. They're a positive thing, they're a wholesome thing, they're a pleasant thing, even for the monks who've attained enlightenment. That once someone has attained enlightenment, they don't go back to, longing for the next iPhone. They've given up those things. They naturally don't have these problems in the mind. And so they enjoy meditating in this way. They enjoy guarding the senses. They enjoy being aware of the body as it moves through space. So, then, this Brahmin is very happy to learn this, but he has a question. And I'll summarize it here because we're running a little short of time. So, he says to the Buddha, Venerable Sir, whenever you give this training to all of your disciples, achieve the goal of this training? Do they all achieve enlightenment? And the Buddha says, well, Brahman, some do and some don't. And the Brahman says, well, that's strange. Why is it? Because you're here, fully enlightened Buddha. The teachings are here and Nibbana is available. It's possible. Why is it? that some of your disciples attain full enlightenment and others don't. And the Buddha says, okay, well, I'll ask you a question in return. Well, there's different ways that the Buddha answers questions. Sometimes he gives a detailed response, an analytical response, like we just heard. But sometimes he answers a question by asking a question. And that's what happens here. He asks the Brahmin, so do you know the road to get to Rajagaha? So Rajagaha was another major city at the time of the Buddha, where the Buddha often lived. He says, Brahmin, do you know the way to get to Rajagaha? The Brahmin says yes. And the Buddha says, well, suppose someone were to come to you and ask, how do I get to Rajagaha? What would you tell them? And the Brahmin says, well, I tell them to go down this road, to go past this city, to go past that city. After that city, he'll come to a certain village, he'll come to a certain town, and he'll need to turn at this place, and then he'll get to Rajagaha. And the Buddha says, well, okay, suppose someone comes to you, they ask for these instructions, they listen to them very carefully, but then they go down the right road, they get to the first city, but they turn and go the wrong way. They don't keep going on the right road. Is that person going to get to Rajagaha? And the Brahmin says, no. The Buddha says, well, look at that. You're here, you know the way to Rajagaha. Right, there is a road, a path to get to Rajagaha, and Rajagaha does exist, right? What's wrong? What's the problem? And the Brahmin says, well, you know, I tell them the right way, but what more can I do? It's up to them to follow my instructions. And the Buddha says, exactly, right? This is what a Buddha does. A Buddha explains the teaching. Right, the teachings are here, the teachings are available. I'm here to share the teachings, he says. And enlightenment is possible. There is this thing, Nibbana. Some of my disciples follow my instructions, some of my disciples don't. What can I do about those that don't? So, when we listen to these teachings, We have to reflect on that, thinking, okay, if I don't achieve this goal, who do I blame? Do I blame the Buddha? Do I blame the teachings? Or do I take responsibility? And we see this a lot, right? People very enthusiastic when they start to learn the Dhamma, start to practice meditation. But then things don't go so smoothly for them. They don't get the results that they want as fast as they want. Maybe they start going down a totally wrong direction. And what do? They blame the teachings. They say, this isn't for real. This isn't possible. This training doesn't work. Right? But are they following the teachings? Probably not. Right? So as disciples, we have to be humble. We have to think, okay, it's my responsibility to follow these teachings. Nobody else can follow them for me. If things aren't going right, then I need to go and talk to someone. Like we learned this morning, that first factor of having kalyanamitta, having spiritual friends. Going to them, the second factor, asking questions. Saying, you know, I don't understand the meaning of this teaching. I don't understand how I'm supposed to live this way. I don't understand what this means. Right? It's up to us. You know, the monks, we're not calling you in the evenings saying, how did your meditation go? Or, you know, did you lie today? Right? Have you been generous today? Right? We're not going to call you up and do that. It's up to you. Right? We're not going to ask every time, do you understand all the precepts? Right? Do you understand how to practice generosity? We may not ask you that every time. Right? It's up to you to come and ask questions. How do I do this? Right? How am I to understand this passage? So then the Brahmin is extremely happy And I'll summarize what he says. He says to the Buddha, you know, there's people in this world who become monks and nuns not because of faith in you, not because of faith in the teachings, not for good reasons, but for bad reasons, just to earn a livelihood, just to get food. Right, in a poor country, it can be hard to even get an ordinary amount of food, and so you become a monk, people give you clothes, they give you food. In some situations, it can be a better life than the one that you have. The Brahmin says, you know, there are people in the world that do that. They just become monks and nuns to earn a living. They have all kinds of bad qualities. They're arrogant, vain. They speak in a very rough way. They don't guard the senses like you've instructed them. They're lazy, they gossip, they don't meditate, they don't practice seclusion. All these terrible monks do exist in the world. But they're not the kind of monks that you live with. You don't want to hang around these monks. And it's true, the Buddha didn't like living with monks like that. And if it was a really bad situation, the Buddha would just move. Not because he had hatred for them, not because he had aversion, but because it's terrible to live with people like that, right? So the Buddha would move on. He'd help as much as he could, he'd see when he was able to help, but if people were really stuck in their own defilements, not willing to follow this gradual training, what can he do? Right? If people don't follow the instructions, what can he do? But then the Brahmin says, but there are clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, who are not fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain. They're not rough-tongued, and they're not loose-spoken. Who are guarded in their sense faculties, who are moderate in eating, who are devoted to wakefulness, who are concerned with recluseship, greatly respectful of the training, not luxurious or careless, are keen to avoid backsliding, leaders in seclusion, energetic, resolute, established in mindfulness, fully aware, concentrated, with undefiled minds, possessing wisdom, not drivelers. Master Gotama dwells together with these. So the Brahmin clearly has a lot of faith in the Buddha, clearly has seen the Sangha, has observed various monks, and says, you know, there are monks who follow these instructions. There are monks who are committed to this training, no matter how difficult it is. And then he gives a very beautiful simile, this Brahmin. Usually it's the Buddha that gives similes, but here this Brahmin praises the Buddha. He says, just as black orris root is reckoned as the best of root perfumes, so a certain kind of plant is the best root perfume, and red sandalwood is considered to be the best of the wood perfumes, and jasmine is said to be the best fragrance of the flower perfumes. So too, Master Gotama's advice is supreme among the teachings of today. So he says, just like in the ordinary world, we can see the finest, the best of something, the sweetest, the most fragrant, the most beautiful. He says, your teachings, among all the teachings in the world, also have the sweetness. They're also the best. And then he praises the Buddha in the way that people often would. He says, magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overturned, revealing what was hidden, showing a way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see. I go to Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma and for refuge to the Sangha of bhikkhus. Let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. So, in this time, we've had the chance to learn along with this good-natured Brahmin, to learn about the Buddha's gradual teaching. We've gotten a reminder that it's up to us to follow these instructions. The Buddha can just point out the way. So having heard these gradual trainings in virtue, training in mindfulness, training in sense restraint, training in wisdom, may we remember these teachings that we've heard. May we reflect on them wisely. May we put these teachings into practice. Through the power of all this action, may we too one day arrive at the supreme bliss of Nibbana in this Gautama Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.